Dozens of civilians are killed in fresh Israeli attacks across Gaza as the death toll for regime's genocidal war tops 30,500. Head of the World Health Organization warns children are dying of starvation in Gaza amid serious shortages of food and medical supplies. And Ural slams UN Security Council's silence on Israeli crimes in Gaza as a license for the regime to kill and starve Palestinians. Now more bloodshed in Gaza, where Israeli forces have been running amok for more than 150 days now. In the latest attacks in southern Gaza, the Israeli military targeted several homes in the cities of Khan Yunis and Rafah. Nearly 30 people were killed in the attacks. Regime's naval forces also shelled shores of Beit Lahia in the north, with no reports of casualties yet. But Israeli troops once again opened fire on Palestinians trying to reach an aid truck in central Gaza City, injuring several people. The death toll from U.S.-Israeli onslaught on Gaza since last October has now risen to above 30,500, with nearly 72,000 people injured. Our correspondent Muti Abu Musabe on the ground in central Gaza City of Deir al-Balah updated us earlier on the situation in the war-ravaged territory.
The Israeli occupation forces attacked the Palestinian civilians who were gathering near Al-Kuwait roundabout in the eastern part of Gaza City. Once again, the Israeli occupation forces attacked those Palestinian civilians who are seeking for having any entry or any access for the humanitarian aid and the humanitarian necessities. A Palestinian civilian was reportedly killed. Dozens were injured over that attack. In the meantime, the Israeli occupation forces renewed and maintained their attacks and their airstrikes against several areas of Gaza Strip. Whereas in Rafah City, the Israeli warplanes carried out several attacks on the area adjacent to the Egyptian borders. In the meantime, the Israeli occupation forces continued their attacks and their strikes against Khan Yunis City, where the eastern parts of Khan Yunis City witnessed heavy bombardments of the Israeli artillery, where the Israeli occupation forces in the western parts of the same city, Khan Yunis City, exploded and blown up several residential buildings. It's worth mentioning that that at least 33 Palestinian dead bodies were extracted from the destroyed residential buildings and the destroyed Palestinian houses in Khan Yunis City. Massive destruction unfolded in the eastern parts of Khan Yunis City.
Now, the World Health Organization warned children in Gaza hospitals are dying of starvation amid dire shortages of food, fuel, and medicine. Now, the warning came after a WHO mission visited the Al-Auda and Kamal Adwan hospitals in northern Gaza. The Gaza Health Ministry says at least 16 children have died of malnutrition in aid-deprived northern Gaza. Now, since last October, over 13,400 children and nearly 9,000 women have been killed in Israeli attacks. The UN Human Rights Chief has warned the genocidal war in Gaza is a powder keg that could ignite a wider conflict in the region and beyond. The U.S. has used its veto power several times to block UN Security Council resolutions critical of Israel's ongoing onslaught on Gaza. The UN General Assembly has met to examine the U.S. veto of the latest Security Council draft resolution calling for a Gaza ceasefire. Now, Riyad Mansour, head of the Palestinian envoy, gave a speech asking the world to hold Israel responsible for crimes it's committing in Gaza.
Israel cannot be allowed to sit among us, lecturing the rest of the world for rejecting its crimes, attacking the UN and its member states, and undermining regional and international peace and security without consequences. They pass laws adopt budgets and determine military strategies, allowing and enabling these crimes. The Israeli Prime Minister has boasted about not abiding by decisions of international courts or UN resolutions and of having torpedoed peace efforts. Look at our children. Look at Yazan. Look what agony they are enduring. Dozen more children who died of malnutrition have been identified, and many more have died and are dying in darkness and destitution. Mr. President, our people are no lesser people. Our people are no lesser people, I repeat. Our children are not less worthy. Their lives are not less sacred. The dehumanization we have endured aims at making the killing of our people more acceptable.
And Iran's ambassador to the UN has also slammed the U.S. veto of the Security Council resolution calling for a Gaza ceasefire. Amir Said Irvani says the shameful move is a license to kill and starve Palestinians. The Iranian envoy made the remarks while addressing the UN General Assembly. Irvani said by vetoing resolutions, U.S. continues to vehemently support ongoing Israeli genocide and provide the regime impunity in its assault on civilians. He said the U.S. move flies in the face of global appeals for an end to the Israeli bloodshed and violates the principles of international law. Washington's veto 3 Security Council resolutions calling for a Gaza ceasefire since October the 7th. The UNRWA chief has warned against a deliberate and concerted Israeli campaign to bring down the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees.
Dismantling UNRWA is short-sighted. By doing so, we will sacrifice an entire generation of children, sowing the seeds of hatred, resentment, and future conflict. The notion that the agency can be dismantled without violating a host of human rights and jeopardizing international peace and security is naive at best.
Excellencies, I'm here today because UNRWA, the United Nations.
Lazzarini said the agency is already at a breaking point and its ability to fulfill its mandate seriously threatened. The UNRWA chief described as unsubstantiated Tel Aviv's allegations that a dozen of the agency's staff members were involved in the October 7th operation against Israel. He also called on countries that have stopped funding UNRWA following the Israeli allegations to resume financial assistance. Lazzarini warned that without additional funding, then UNRWA will be in uncharted territory with serious implications for global peace and security. UNRWA says Israeli authorities have extracted forced confessions from its staff by torturing, abusing, and sexually exploiting them during interrogations. And tensions continue to mount across the occupied West Bank as Israeli forces storm Palestinians' administrative capital, Ramallah. At least one Palestinian was killed and several injured and detained by occupation forces. Moni Kandil joined us earlier for your details.
During this one of the Israeli military raids this morning to Al-Amali refugee camp north Al-Biri city, the Israelis abducted at least seven Palestinians from Al-Amali refugee camp. During the military operation, Israeli forces used excessive force as the Israeli forces are used to. They shot and killed 16-year-old Mustafa Abu Shalbak. He's from the nearby refugee camp of Qalandia. But when the Israeli forces stormed the refugee camp, the Palestinians, the residents of the other areas, came to the refugee camp of Al-Amali in order to prevent the military operation to continue. A number of Palestinians had been wounded. At least 7 Palestinians were detained in addition to the killing of this Palestinian teenager in the Al-Amali refugee camp. During the operation, the Israelis said that at least 2 Israeli forces had been shot and wounded while they raided the Al-Amali refugee camp. According to the Palestinian Ministry of Health, the Israelis had killed 420 Palestinians since the 7th of October when the Israelis started the Israeli aggression on the Gaza Strip. So 420 Palestinians were killed here in the occupied West Bank. According to the Palestinian Commission of Prisoners Affairs, today the Israeli forces have detained 55 Palestinians. The majority of those Palestinians were arrested in Al-Khalil. At least 20 Palestinians had been detained. 10 of them were former prisoners. Others were children.
The Lebanese Hezbollah resistance movement has warned any Israeli act of aggression against the Arab country will ignite an advanced version of the 33-day war in 2006. The movement's deputy secretary general said at a Beirut conference that resistance fighters will eventually emerge triumphant despite all challenges. Mariam Saleh reports.
Hezbollah's Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem stressed the readiness of the Lebanese resistance to face any possible Israeli aggression against Lebanon. He said any Israeli act of aggression would trigger an advanced version of the 2006 war, when the Tel Aviv regime suffered a humiliating defeat at the hands of Hezbollah.
The Zionist enemy continues to threaten us with military aggression. We respond by means of steadfastness, resistance, and retaliatory strikes. We hereby declare that if they commit a foolish act and attack our territories, there would then be a new version of the July 2006 war.
He warned Israelis that Hezbollah would fight in an even more sophisticated manner in any future confrontation, stressing that the outcome will eventually be a victory for the resistance fighters. Sheikh Qasem was speaking at the 6th International Conference for the Union of Resistance Scholars in Lebanon's capital, Beirut. Representatives of the Palestinian resistance factions also stressed that the United States' all-out support for the Israeli warmongering policies has given a cover to the Israeli regime to continue its atrocities as its genocidal Gaza war has marked 150 days. Hamas official Osama Hamdan stressed that Muslim nations are duty-bound to foil U.S.-Israeli plots against war-torn Gaza.
It is the duty of Arabs and Muslims worldwide to take the initiative and foil Israel's conspiracy of starvation. The countries neighboring the Gaza Strip must not stand idly by and should take a concrete measure, especially for Gazans in the north.
Scholars and thinkers from diverse Muslim countries have come together to voice their support for the Palestinian people and the resistance. They sent a message of solidarity for Palestinians in war-torn Gaza as Israel's unbridled and unfazed brutality continues unabated.
50 scholars, top scholars from 25 countries, they are gathered here, and hopefully they will reach to any kind of the solution, kind of support and solidarity for the people.
The Palestinians are sending a very strong message. That look, you'll be answerable to this. You know, the accountability is not only in Israel who are the murderers, but accountability should also be there among the Muslims. Why are you not doing anything? So that's why Palestinians are giving that voice. They are struggling, they're saying they're going to fight to the end, and therefore they say if you want to help, it's your responsibility, it's not we appealing.
With the Israeli regime's genocidal war in Gaza now in its 5th month and over 30,000 civilian fatalities, scholars in Beirut assert that the resistance in the region has no choice but to continue its armed struggle until the final victory.
The Muslim clerics in support of the resistance have stressed through their discussions and meetings here in Beirut that the Palestinian cause is a reason for unity and solidarity. They say the teachings of the Quran have drawn a roadmap for supporting the Palestinian people in their struggle to free a land considered holy to all Muslims. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
The Yemeni army says it successfully carried out an operation against an Israeli ship in the Arabian Sea. According to the Yemeni army spokesperson, the attack targeted the MSC Sky. Brigadier General Yahya Sadi stressed Yemeni forces will not hesitate to perform more military operations in the Red and Arabian Seas in support of Palestinians. He also said the operations will continue until Israeli aggression stops and the siege on Gaza is lifted. The operation came only hours after Yemeni forces launched ballistic missiles and drones at a number of U.S. warships in the Red Sea. Hundreds of Austrians have once again taken to the streets of the capital, Vienna, to protest U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza. Demonstrators gathered at Vienna's main square, waving Palestinian flags and holding banners that read, "Hands off Rafah and Palestinian Lives Matter." The protesters called for an immediate ceasefire and delivery of humanitarian aid to Gaza. They also urged a boycott of goods manufactured by businesses linked to Israel. They also condemned the silence of the European Union in the face of Israeli crimes. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The head of a Norway-based NGO has been shocked after witnessing the catastrophic humanitarian conditions in Rafah in southern Gaza caused by the Zionist regime's months-long genocidal war on the besieged Palestinian territory. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, visiting a school sheltering some 4,500 displaced Palestinians who fled Gaza City in the north of the territory and nearby Khan Yunis, Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, NRC, in a post published on X platform, recently expressed his dismay at the living conditions they were enduring. He said, "The disabled, the pregnant, and the newborn share 18 latrines with 4,500 others. Malnutrition, epidemic disease, and trauma is everywhere." Egeland slammed the Zionist regime and its allies for carrying out a relentless onslaught against the besieged civilian population of Gaza and called it a stain on an international community which has failed to secure any kind of restraint or humanitarian access. He called the situation in Gaza in an interview with CNN recently, "People are traumatized beyond belief and live under the most horrific condition." In an earlier post from the Rafah border crossing into Gaza, Egeland said hundreds of aid trucks were waiting to travel into the Palestinian territory to help a starving civilian population. He added, "The system is broken," he said, of the process involved in allowing aid into Gaza, adding, "Israel could fix it for the sake of the innocent." Recently, a United Nations official said that Israeli forces are systematically blocking access to people in need in Gaza complicating the task of delivering aid to the besieged Palestinian territory. Rafah, the town along the Egyptian border, which was once deemed a safe zone by the Zionist regime military forces, has now become the last refuge for over half of Gaza's entire population of more than 2.3 million who have fled their homes in other parts of the territory to shelter from incessant Israeli regime attacks. At least 500,000 people are facing famine in Gaza, while the entire population of the territory is experiencing acute food shortage, according to figures from the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA. Over 30,000 Palestinians, including 14,000 children, have been killed in Gaza, 146 days into the latest offensive launched by the child killer regime of Israel, according to Gaza's health ministry. The Electronic Intifada also wrote, Ahmad Hanun and his extended family are now living on a poultry farm in Rafah. In southern Gaza, their rudimentary shelter is not suitable accommodation for humans, but they have nowhere else to go. There are so many others in a similar situation. About 1.3 million people, more than half of all Gaza's inhabitants, are crammed into Rafah following mass displacement. The Hanuns were forced to leave their home in Sheikh Radwan neighborhood of Gaza City. The Zionist regime has repeatedly bombarded the area during the current genocidal war. The farm where they are now living does not have a bathroom. To use one, they visit Al Hilal Al Emirati, a maternity hospital in Rafah. The family have arranged showers among the farm's battery cages. They have boiled water on a wood fire before showering. Ahmad Hanun said, "We have to strip off in front of each other. There is no privacy during the war. The farm where they live smells terribly and they constantly have to contend with insects. The children have experienced diarrhea. Loy, a 7-year-old boy, has been diagnosed with hepatitis A. His health is in a very serious condition. When it rains heavily, the area where they live has been flooded by sewage, destroying blankets, mattresses, and even food. The family's only protection during wet weather is to stay inside the cages." Ahmad Hanun said, "I find it unbelievable that we live in such filth. This is a place for animals and birds, not people. We had anticipated staying here for a few days until we found somewhere more suitable, but we haven't managed to find anywhere else." Adel Jom'e had to flee his home in Jabalia refugee camp, northern Gaza, a few months ago. First, he and his family went to Khan Yunis in the south. Later, they moved to Rafah. After seeking an apartment in Rafah, they realized that they could not afford the high rents being charged. They ended up assembling a tent on the grounds of a zoo owned by a relative. That means they have to live beside animals who are starving. A number of the lions in the zoo have already died since the war began. With food scarce, the zoo's owner is trying to keep the remaining lions alive with bread. The lions had previously eaten chicken. The zoo animal's weight has fallen drastically. The bathroom in the zoo is located close to the animal's cages. Adel's 7-year-old son, Rami, is terrified of going to the bathroom after dark. The boy started experiencing severe pains recently. When he was brought to hospital, he was diagnosed with kidney stones and required surgery. The doctor told the family that such problems can occur if children try to avoid urinating. Rami has trouble sleeping as he is afraid of the lions. He has asked his parents repeatedly if the animals can escape from the cages and attack humans. Sarah, his mother, replied that animals pose no risk to people who feed and care for them. Sarah said, Rami is always asking when he can leave this horrific place and go back to our old home. I don't know how to answer him. I am lost for words. Yasser Helles and his family are now living in a greenhouse near Rafah's seashore. Given that the Zionist regime's naval forces are firing toward Rafah, the area is anything but safe. The family had to take shelter there as tents in short supply and the few available ones costly. Yasser said, It takes weeks just for a charity to give you one. There are so many people on the list for tents, so we were forced to take shelter here, which is not a suitable place to live. Ahmad Yasser's 15-year-old son recently went to a local school and queued for hours before he could find water. Once his container was filled, he used a wheelchair to transport it. Yet the wheelchair fell over and water spilled. On his way back to his family, Ahmad was distraught. Since they have taken shelter in the greenhouse, the extended family have been sleeping on mattresses. Yasser's 72-year-old mother has experienced backache. Yasser said, I often could not find painkillers for her in pharmacies or in UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees clinics. She cannot bear the agony.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, let us listen to a saying from the martyr of Karbala, the Holy Prophet's younger grandson, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, about the savior of humanity. The ninth of my descendants is the Imam who will rise with the truth. God will grant life to earth through him after its death. The true faith will supersede all religions through him. His absence shall be lengthy, during which many people will go astray. Only a few will remain on the right path. They shall suffer pains. People will put pressure on them, saying, Let us know when this promise of the return of the Mahdi is fulfilled. Those who will bear the pains and denials patiently will get the same rewards as those who accompanied the Prophet during his expeditions for jihad.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how can we change that bad habit of ours?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is an honor to be here at your service. Dear listeners, we are talking about how can we just get rid of that bad habit of ours when it comes to our Islamic lifestyle. Now, there's a couple of things that we need to take into consideration when we are talking about a bad habit. So first and foremost, you know, there are certain bad habits which are, you know, they're not really religiously considered to be bad habits. I don't know, they're just kind of these things that we have, you know, we've become accustomed to doing over the years, but there are certain bad habits which are religiously considered to be bad habits. So, for example, you know, lying or backbiting or cheating or stealing. I don't know. These are things that are very apparently and very overtly they're bad habits. God forbid that they don't become habits, but they are bad habits that are religiously, you know, prohibited bad habits. But, you know, some things are not religiously prohibited bad habits. I mean, so, I don't know, for example, you have a, I guess it could be considered a bad habit, you know, that you like to put your fork on the right side of your plate or something like that. I don't know, the things that are not religiously prohibited. Now, we're talking about primarily those habits which are religiously prohibited. You know, these kind of negative qualities that appear, you know, in a human being, and how to fix that. So that is primarily what we're talking about on this session. Now, how do we get rid of these bad habits? Well, we already talked about the first aspect and the first step, which is to be able to identify, you know, what bad habit we're talking about and what bad habit, you know, we need to fix within ourselves. So the first step, of course, is to be able to identify what it is that we are doing, you know, which is a religiously prohibited bad habit, so that slowly but surely we can work on that and hopefully be able to get rid of that pesky little bad habit. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about how to get rid of that Islamically prohibited bad habit so that we can achieve that ultimate Islamic lifestyle. Now, of course, you know, this takes time. It takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of practice, you know. Unfortunately, you know, sometimes we grow up and we pick up these bad habits. And as we said, religiously prohibited bad habits over the years. And then, you know, when we become relative adults and we grow up, if you will, we realize that these habits have become a part of us, and they become, well, much more difficult to be able to handle and to be able to remove from ourselves. And this here is something that's really important for any parent out there, is to make sure that you get rid of these bad habits in your children before they grow up and before these things become a habit. And especially those habits which are religiously prohibited. And this is one of the perhaps one of the greatest responsibilities of a parent, and that is to be able to help to control certain religiously prohibited bad habits that might, you know, become habits for their children. So anyways, it takes a lot of time. Of course, we said that the first step is to be able to identify that this is a bad habit, and then you kind of make a plan of action in order to prevent yourself from falling into that bad habit, in order to protect yourself from being in a situation where you are, you know, kind of forced to fall into that bad habit, and make sure that, you know, you remove yourself from any kind of situations that will push you towards that bad habit, whether it's lying or stealing or whatever it may be. You have to identify, and then it's a relatively long process. You know, don't think that it's going to be, you know, overnight you're going to be able to fix all of your bad habits. No, it takes time, it takes perseverance, it takes determination, you know. And some of these spiritual wayfaring masters, they have said that it has taken them a whole lifetime to be able to control something. And there are some who have said that despite being able to control a certain bad habit for their whole lifetime, they are still afraid and they are still very careful because they might fall into the same trap. But nonetheless, the fact that you are trying to remove that bad habit is something which is commendable, and it will eventually, inshallah, by the grace and the blessings of Allah, it will help you to attain that Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Amazon.
Part 2.
In this situation, it is natural that no publisher can compete with Amazon. Even other big competitors cannot win in this situation. Even the world's technology giant, Apple, fails as well. In 2010, Amazon had 95% of the audiobook market share, and Apple wanted to be part of the deal. Apple executives arranged meetings with five major publishers and suggested that the pricing iBook be done by the publishers and 30% of the profit would go to Apple. Meanwhile, Bezos announced that the price of audiobooks would be reduced to 99 cents. A few weeks after the decision of the publishers and Apple, Amazon filed complaints against these companies in the Federal Trade Commission. In the spring of 2012, the U.S. Court of Justice found Apple and five publishers guilty of conspiring to raise prices and prevent competition. Finally, all publishers negotiated and agreed with the government.
Amazon's battle with Hachette and the authors that Hachette publishes is heating up.
Macmillan and Penguin had to pay $20 million and $75 million respectively. It was a large amount of money that was difficult to pay in a business that always suffered from a lack of profit. Apple appealed the Supreme Court ruling. In the summer of the same year, the judge ruled in favor of the government and, in fact, Amazon. Apple was sentenced to pay $845 million in damages because the company had violated antitrust laws, according to the government. In fact, the government believed that Amazon operated completely based on the free market and competition rules. However, at the end of the day, Amazon monopolized the audiobook market. After this decision, many people talked about Bezos' secret relationship with American judges and, of course, the government. Exactly 3 weeks after winning the court case against Apple, Barack Obama visited an Amazon warehouse in the Chattanooga area where workers were paid an average of $11 an hour. He praised the creation of decent employment by Amazon.
It's great to be here at Amazon!
Everything was coordinated to benefit Bezos the most.
Last year, during the busiest day of the Christmas rush, customers around the world ordered more than 300 items from Amazon every second.
Reducing prices is the biggest service that Amazon has provided to its customers. However, it was possible to reduce the prices and the cost until a certain time. From then on, he had to play the game based on his own rules. Amazon warehouses are built in cities with the highest unemployment rates, with the lowest wages for workers. In recent years, Amazon has contributed a lot to the employment of Americans and has hired 30,000 people a year. Workers who enter these warehouses do not have the right to be members of any union. According to eyewitnesses, they work in strange conditions.
You have security cameras right behind you at all times that are looking at you 24/7. And if you don't meet standards or the rates, you're out the door, you're just disposable.
Every worker has a scanner at all times that basically track exactly where you're at.
And they have a little blue line at the bottom of the screen, and it has like how many seconds that you have to have it done by the time it hits zero. And it puts you into panic mode.
And pretty much you can't talk to people. You can't be in the same aisle as them. You just constantly have to sit there scanning like a robot all day long. If they catch you not scanning, you get a write-up.
And what they're doing is they're producing this massive data that they are using to be able to analyze the entire workforce.
Each worker in this department walks about 11 miles per shift, considering such restrictions. The worker has only 33 seconds in order to pack a product. In the US, they hired 47 people for this type of jobs for every $10 million in revenue. This figure for Amazon is 14 people for every $10 million. This situation reminds everyone of Modern Times, directed by Charlie Chaplin. Everyone has only one task to do in these warehouses, and there is no such thing as creativity. Bezos also eliminates publishers to reduce the costs. Amazon has been publishing books for many years. If you want your books to be published in audio format, you will receive up to 70% of the revenue. This figure is about 15% in the printed books of other publishers. Publishers are worried about Amazon's policy, because right now, it is Amazon that has control over everything and has created a kind of monopoly in book industry. When customers and publishers are satisfied, there is no one left to claim anything. The US government also supports Amazon and the US citizens. All 130 companies of the Amazon group are active in the fashion industry, chain supermarkets, bag and shoe sales, podcast production, cloud storage, books, photography, data analysis, cinema, and several other areas. It is a huge organization in which everything exists, and that is indicated in the Amazon logo. There is a yellow arrow that goes from A to Z. It means that there is everything in Amazon, but Jeff Bezos thinks that you can't find everything in Amazon, but Amazon in everything itself. When you check IMDb site, when you purchase from Whole Food Market, when you buy shoes from Zappos, when you buy groceries from Amazon Fresh, when you buy clothes from ShopBop, when you use AWS and check all sites to buy online products, you're actually active in Amazon and help Jeff Bezos get richer. When you watch a movie on Netflix, you're actually helping Bezos because Netflix uses AWS. That is why Jeff Bezos is the richest man in the world.
Breaking news tonight, a stunner from the richest man in the world.
Bezos knows people's interests because he's well aware of their taste in choosing books. In fact, Bezos was one of the first people to understand that information was the most valuable thing in cyberspace and the internet. Many experts believe that selling books was just a way for Bezos to collect information from people. Bezos now owns the information of millions of people around the world and has managed to launch Amazon's warehouses. Amazon warehouses store products that the customer does not know about. But Amazon predicts that people will need these products in the near future and stores them in warehouses near customers' houses.
He was part of the online revolution that put the future of printed word up in the air. Can he help save it? Within the last few minutes, CNN has learned that Jeff Bezos, the founder and CEO of Amazon.com, is buying the Washington Post.
In 2015, Jeff Bezos bought Washington Post for $250 million. It was strange because Bezos was not interested in paper and printing. But he bought the Washington Post company's newspaper publishing business. When he first visited the Washington Post, he clearly manifested his feelings. He asked the managers to look for a tablet for reading a newspaper. In fact, Bezos became more powerful by buying the Washington Post. Now he is a man with a lot of money, media, and a lot of information. He only needs weapons to create a self-governing government.
This deal could give him more influence over politics.
Nobody hangs out in Washington, D.C. just to go to the free museums. You buy a home in Washington, you buy a newspaper in Washington because it is the most influential city in the world and you want to lay your hands on that power.
It is not possible for many people in the world to live without Amazon. This company has become so big that others have to adapt themselves to it. It is just like the Amazon River, because there is life next to it. But if there is a fluvial, people will lose their lives for sure. People's lives are affected by any small change in Amazon. Companies that prefer to be a part of Amazon instead of confronting it are best described in a sentence in A Flag of Sunrise book by Robert Stone. Sometimes the mouse is so afraid that it endangers itself and goes to the cat itself. It seems that the cat and mouse game has entered a new era. Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Bahrain Grand Prix is 20 years old this weekend, but away from the celebrations on the track, activists tell a dark story of power and repression. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Middle East I wrote, Musa Satrabi was 22 when the Grand Prix came to his home. At the time, he barely noticed the arrival in 2004 of the motorsport in the island kingdom of Bahrain, the smallest country in the Persian Gulf, was being trumpeted by politicians and the ruling royal family. But Satrabi, who holds a diploma in industrial rigging, had more pressing concerns. After 3 months, he had been made redundant from his job at the Bahrain Petroleum Company, BAPCO, as migrant workers, mainly from India and Nepal, were shipped in to replace locals. Satrabi and some other workers who had been laid off started protesting in front of the royal palace. They held signs that read, "We are Bahraini and we don't have a job," and "We are Bahraini and we are looking for a job." One day, the protesters saw a convoy of large vehicles heading in direction of Sakhir, the site of the $150 million circuit that was set to host the inaugural Grand Prix. Preparations were being made. The race was taking place that weekend. Satrabi told Middle East Eye, "The police came and they hit us. They said that they wanted to talk to us about our situation, that the authorities wanted to help us, and that we could discuss what was happening. The protesters went with the police out of sight of the palace and the main road leading to the track." Satrabi said, "It was just a way of moving us so that we wouldn't be seen by journalists and people going to the Grand Prix." At various points, Satrabi told MEE, key Bahraini leaders, including General Khalifa Al-Fadla, came to tell the protesters that they wanted to talk to them and that they would work things out. But the promise of a fair hearing never materialized. As well as protesting unemployment, Satrabi is part of Bahrain's Shia majority, which has suffered waves of repression in a country ruled for over two centuries by the Al Khalifa royal family. One night in March 2005, at around midnight, five cars arrived at Satrabi's house. Security forces took the young Bahraini, bundled him into one of the vehicles, and moved him to what he describes as a hidden place. He told MEE, preferring not to share further details of the assault, "They beat me and said that if we continued to protest, they would go after my wife and family. They took my clothes off and assaulted me." Satravi was left lying in the street, dependent on the strangers to drive him home, where his distraught wife saw the blood on his clothes. The next year, with another Bahrain Grand Prix on the horizon, Satravi and his fellow protesters organized demonstrations to try and get some attention for the cause, which by now had broadened into a movement calling for dignity and an end to political repression in Bahrain. Outside the Dana Mall, the Seif district of Manama, Bahrain's capital, journalists and other people involved in F1 had seen the protesters. Satravi said, "The police used tear gas and rubber bullets on us after we had been seen by F1 buses. They besieged the mall and," Satravi said, "tied the protesters up. In the aftermath of the confrontation, he was sentenced to 9 months in prison." Saturday, March 2nd, Bahrain Grand Prix marks the 20th anniversary of the inaugural race. For the country's rulers, it is a time for special celebrations to mark Bahrain's landmark 20th anniversary in motorsport. For pro-democracy activists from Bahrain, including the Bahrain Institute for Rights and Democracy, the race is testament to a troubling 20-year legacy of sports washing in Bahrain. Sayed Al-Wadai, Birds Advocacy Director, attended the first Bahrain Grand Prix, getting in with a free ticket the authorities handed out to all school and university students because they wanted to make sure there was a substantial crowd. He told MEE, "The government made a big deal about it. I went, but we didn't understand what was going on. We could just hear lots of very noisy cars." Today, Al-Wadai, who is one of the most prominent Bahraini activists in the world, says that what hurts the most is when F1 makes truly astonishing false claims that it is a force for good. How can this be the case when your partners won't tolerate any form of protest? Bahrain's human rights record over the past 20 years has become significantly worse, with a major setback in 2011 when the mass protest movement was crushed and the race was cancelled. The Bahraini activist had been joined by a group of British politicians, including former Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn and former Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell, who wrote to F1's leadership on February 28. The MPs and Lords wrote, "While F1 remains delusional about its impact, evidence illustrates that the human rights situation in Bahrain has significantly deteriorated over the past two decades." They highlighted the case of Salah Abbas Habib, a 36-year-old anti-government protester who was found dead on the eve of the Bahrain Grand Prix in 2012. The motorsport has not investigated whether the death was linked to its presence in the island kingdom. A spokesperson for F1 told MEE, "For decades, Formula One has worked hard to be a positive force everywhere in races, including economic, social, and cultural benefits. Sports like Formula One are uniquely positioned to cross borders and cultures to bring countries and communities together to share the passion and excitement of incredible competition and achievement. We take our responsibilities on rights very seriously and set high ethical standards for counterparts and those in our supply chain, which are enshrined in contracts, and we pay close attention to their adherence." Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. This is Palestine Declassified. We're the only weekly show that's dedicated to investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In this week's show, we'll be analysing the prospects for pro-Palestine candidates who'll be standing against mainstream political parties in the upcoming British general election, which must be called within the next 10 months. Latifa Abu Chakra has been looking at some of the constituencies where pro-Palestine candidates have already been selected.